from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ramadan, the Muslim holy month, begins this Sunday evening. It's a time of fasting, not just from food, but also from speaking ill of others. Muslims are instructed to practice patience and gratitude and seek a kind of spiritual renewal. American Muslims can probably use a deep breath. They've seen terror attacks in the name of ISIS in Paris and San Bernardino. The rhetoric coming from Donald Trump's presidential campaign, Islamophobia, young Muslims enticed into radicalization, and the ongoing debate about accepting Syrian refugees. We want to know what they're thinking, feeling, this hour On Point, a roundtable of Muslim Americans. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Muslim Americans, let's talk. How do things look to you now as we head into the weekend and beginning of Ramadan? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Dalia Mogahed. She's Director of Research for the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding. It's a Muslim issues think tank, co-author of Who Speaks for Islam? What a billion Muslims really think. She's former chair of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies and appointed by President Obama to the Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships in 2009. Dalia Mogahed, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Your outfit recently did a big survey of American Muslims and how they were looking at the world. What were your big findings?
I think some of the biggest findings is actually how positive people were about the direction of the country. And I think that speaks mostly to their high approval rating of the president. But at the same time, Muslims were the most likely faith community that we surveyed to report religiously based discrimination. The majority said that they had experienced some level of discrimination in the last year. And this group, people who say that they have, you know, experienced it on a regular basis, say that they are a lot less optimistic, but at the same time, more likely to be active in their community and press for change.
Did they describe the sources or the reasons for that discrimination that they were feeling?
Well, it was just actually asking people if they felt that they had been discriminated against because of their religion. So we didn't ask where, you know, the discrimination occurred. Mm-hmm. But we did see that women, young people, and people without a college education were more likely to say that they experienced it than other Muslims. So this kind of discrimination is really impacting the most vulnerable in the community.
The Muslim population in the country, I mean, we don't ask on the census. The U.S. Census doesn't ask. But the Pew Research Organization says 3.3 million Muslims in the United States in 2015, about 1% of the total U.S. population. What's the growth of that been? What's projected, Dalia? Do you know?
I think Pew said that the projected growth is that Muslims will be the second largest faith community after Christians by 2050. So it's a growing population, both because of conversion and immigration. I think what's really important, though, is to ask, what does it mean to be an American? And I think that that's really what we're facing right now. I think we're much more than this being about what's going on inside the Muslim community. I think this is about what's going on inside America and how we are defining our identity as Americans. Right now, it seems that there's a divide between Americans who believe the concept of being American means a set of ideas that anyone can be an American. And then there's another group that believes America is a kind of caste system, that only a certain ethnicity or a certain religion is a real American. And that really is the battle right now.
Do you see any difficulty for American Muslims wholly accepting the ideas or ideals that are seen as, by one of those definitions, as the framework for Americanness?
Actually, the poll sets to rest this question of being if you can be totally American and totally Muslim. And the answer is yes, because Muslims with a high religious identity that identify strongly with Islam and being a Muslim are actually more likely to also identify strongly with being an American. That a strong religious identity among Muslims actually correlates with a an even stronger American identity than Muslims with a low, a weak religious identity. This idea that the two identities are in competition or incompatible is just not supported by the evidence.
One of the headlines that I found interesting out of your survey was that mosque attendance, attending mosque regularly, you found linked to civic engagement, not radicalization.
Exactly. People who attended a mosque once a week or more were more likely to be registered to vote, to be civically engaged or volunteer in their neighborhood to fix a problem with other people, and to have a desire to vote. So mosque attendance was correlated with the kind of activity that a group like ISIS wants to destroy. They argue that only violence can make change, and going to a mosque is actually linked to peaceful means of change, political activism and involvement.
Dahlia, please stand by there in Washington. It is great to have you with us. Ramadan begins Sunday evening. A month of fasting will begin then. We pulled together a roundtable of Muslim Americans from right across the country, from New York, from Michigan, from California. And if you'll stand by, Dahlia, let me introduce them. Dean Obadiah joins us from New York, comedian, host of the Dean Obadiah Show, focuses on Muslim issues on Sirius XM Radio. He's co-director of the 2012 documentary, The Muslims Are Coming, a comedy documentary, sort of a road show. Columnist at The Daily Beast, born in New Jersey to a Palestinian father, Italian mother. Dean Obadiah, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thanks very much. Thanks for doing this panel, to be honest, because we tend to get invited in the media when it's response to bad things. It's great to have an opportunity to tell our story in a time when we're just talking about issues of the day. So thank you, Tom.
Very happy to do it and happy to have you here. From Detroit, Michigan, we're joined by Dawood Waleed, Imam and Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, in Michigan there, or his area there. A U.S. Navy veteran, African American, born in the U.S., grew up in Virginia. His father converted to Islam. His mother's Christian. Dawood Waleed, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be on.
And from Cupertino, California, Hosai Mojedidi joins us by Skype, activist, mother, blogger, co-founder of a website focusing on mental health for Muslims. Previously lived in Southern California, took part in a Meet a Muslim community outreach event last year after the San Bernardino shooting. She was born in Afghanistan, moved to the U.S. with her family as a refugee when she was 2 years old. Hosai in Cupertino, thank you very much for being with us, Hosai.
Hello, Tom. Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Can we just talk for a second about preparations for the holiday that's coming up? Can you describe what will happen Sunday evening in your home or the homes of many American Muslims around the country to bring in Ramadan, Hosai?
Well, I personally, I love this time of the year. I have two little ones. And I also I led a co-op of preschoolers. So we always, you know, use this time to really just inspire a lot of festivity, get the kids excited, even though they don't have to fast, for them to realize that this is a month of community. It's a month of service. It's a month of charity. It's a month of really just being very proud of our faith, not that we're not throughout the year, but especially during this month, because we do have much more involvement with the mosque. We tend to visit each other more, to break fast with other family members and friends. So the kids really love it. And then, of course, the greatest opportunity for them is the end of the month, where they get to get fun gifts and money, and just, you know, we make it really fun for them. So throughout the year, there's a lot of storytelling. Throughout the month, there's a lot of storytelling. And, you know, even when we break the fast together, we get them involved. They bring out the dates. My kids, anyway, they prepare the platter for breaking the fast of dates and water for me and my husband. And, you know, just really get them involved in understanding why we fast, the fact that we do this to really identify with people throughout the world who, this is their daily experience. You know, our kids are very privileged to live here and to have, three hot meals a day, to have a roof over their head. So we really want them to connect with children throughout the world who do not have those opportunities and those, you know, those privileges. So, yeah, it's a wonderful time for us.
Dawood Waleed in Detroit, you're an imam. How do you see the spiritual side of Ramadan? What does it mean to you? Ask of you.
Well, Ramadan, the purpose of fasting is to cultivate God consciousness, or what is called taqwa in the Quran, of us being more regardful, not just of our relationship to God, but also relationship to God's creation. So the mosque in metropolitan Detroit which normally aren't as packed every day of the week. Our mosque will be full at night. Besides my duties at CARE Michigan, I will be at a number of mosques giving lectures on the exegesis of the Quran right before its fast breaking time. And it's really a festive time of not just cultivating individual spirituality, but also cultivating a community where people from different ethnic groups, different social, economic backgrounds come to mosque, break fast, and worship together. It's a beautiful time.
Dean, we've got 1 minute before a break here, but help me out. We're gonna sit and really work with this. But stand back. In the years since 9/11, have things gotten better or worse for Muslim Americans in terms of how the country seems to be open or closed to them, see them, accept or not accept them?
I think, honestly, it's the most challenging time today to be Muslim in America than it was at any time in my adult life. So pre-9/11, there were some issues, but after 9/11, it became very challenging. Now it has become more and more difficult. And frankly, you can point it to the rise of groups like ISIS, but also the rhetoric of politicians, Donald Trump, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, and numerous lower-level politicians who have been demonizing Muslims. And that plays a role. Politicians, their biggest thing, in my view, is not to legislate. It's to set a tone. And when you set a tone over and over 3 years saying Muslims want to oppose Islamic law, which is not true, but we want to oppose Islamic law and destroy America from within. And even as a comedian, I've been accused of trying to wage a stealth jihad, somehow making people, through each joke I tell, somehow they becomes more Islamic in this country. So we struggle on every level there. Ultimately, we're going to prevail. But it's very, you know, it's a challenging time. And I really feel for the younger kids, because we've seen a spike in bullying. And to me, that's the most heartbreaking part of this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we are talking before Sunday evening's start of Ramadan with American Muslims about being Muslim in America now. You can join us this hour. Everyone is welcome here, and Muslim listeners in particular, when you gather for Ramadan. What will the conversations be like this year? How do you understand what's going on with ISIS, with the trickle of radicalization, with Donald Trump and his call to ban Muslim entry? What do all Americans need to understand about the Muslim community now? Where's the center of gravity, politically, emotionally, in your community, your mosque, your life these days? Has it been an easy time for American Muslims? No, it is not. December last year, Republican presidential then candidate, now presumptive nominee of the party, Donald Trump called for a ban on Muslims entering the United States.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Of course, it came just days after the December 2nd shooting in San Bernardino, California. Terrible. 14 people killed there by the two attackers at a holiday work lunch in San Bernardino, where one of the attackers had worked. 5 days later, Assistant Director of the FBI office in Los Angeles, David Bowditch, addressed the media on the shooting investigation, saying they believed both suspects had been radicalized.
As the investigation has progressed, we have learned and believe that both subjects were radicalized and have been for quite some time. Now, how did that happen? The question we're trying to get at is how did that happen and by whom and where did that happen? And I will tell you right now, we don't know those answers at this point.
There's the rough stuff, but there's also just life going on. Here's the sound of a large Eid celebration. That's the holiday celebrating the end of Ramadan. This was in Brooklyn Park last year, filmed by the New York Times. Well, you get the idea. A lot of people celebrating the end of a month of fasting there, families and American Muslims, people just exercising their religion in this country. We've got a big panel with us today from right across that country. Dean Obadalla is with us from New York City, comedian, director, former lawyer Hosai Mojaddedi is with us from Cupertino, California, community activist there, took part in the Meet a Muslim program there. And originally from Afghanistan, came as at two years of age as a refugee. Dawood Walid is with us from Detroit. He's an imam. He's executive director of the Michigan chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And from Washington, Dalia Mogahed joins us. She's director of research at the Institute for Social Policy and understanding. You can join us as well, 800-423-8255. Hosai in California, Dean in New York says, things have never been tougher for Muslim Americans than they are right now. Do you agree? And what's the evidence?
You know, Tom, my experience, I think, has been pretty unique because, as you mentioned, I was in Southern California up until just a few months ago.
Yeah.
So following the San Bernardino attacks, I definitely felt the spike in tension and the hatred towards Islam and Muslims. I had people giving me ugly looks, shaking their heads, making comments about my headscarf, my hijab. And I even had someone try to run me and my kids off the road from behind us, then drive up next to us, curse at us, call us terrorists before driving off. So that was immediately following the attacks. And that actually was one of the reasons why I felt the need to do something. And so I followed the example of a Muslim woman named Mona Haider, who's the one who did the first Meet a Muslim event. Mm-hmm. And I gathered my friends and said, you know, we have to do something. We're right here in this community. We are feeling it. Tensions are really high. People are afraid to go out. I had several people, women who wear the hijab, contact me personally and tell me they wanted to remove their hijab as a result of the fear that they were feeling of just going out to work and school. They just didn't feel safe anymore. So I said, we have to do something. And, you know, I felt really inspired by Mona's example. So we got together and we had a wonderful experience. We had a lot of people come up to us. Some people were emotional. I mean, there were no words exchanged. They just came, hugged us and were crying because they felt really terrible for the things that we were being blamed for, even though we've done nothing. And then we had other people very hostile towards us. So it was really difficult, but you know, those were few and far between. We had much more positive experiences there. But when I moved here to Northern California, and I think, I'm not sure, you know, what the different variables are of why things are so different here, but I've had a different experience. People are extremely warm and welcoming, educated. I went to an event at the local library where there was a local imam offering a talk, just sort of an introduction on Islam. And I actually went there hesitant, thinking he's probably going to receive some negative, people there, people just with an agenda. And maybe as a Muslim woman, I can come just kind of be in the background, offer support if there are any such incidences. And I was so impressed by the level of education of the attendance. I mean, it was a packed room, mostly non-Muslims, and they had really just informed questions about Islam. They weren't at all coming from, you know, what unfortunately we've heard repeatedly through the media and through some of the supporters of other of people like Donald Trump, where they just clearly don't know anything about Islam and Muslims. These were people who had studied Islam, they knew about Islam, but they were just really asking very important questions about, for example, one woman asked about the media and how we felt, you know, whether or not we as a community felt misrepresented, underrepresented. And she actually had a blog that she started with this in mind, with the state of how Muslims are treated in the media as part of her own personal effort to try to help. And so it was really amazing to see, you know, my two different experiences just a few months apart.
Dahlia, I've got a friend in Northern California who's a doctor. And I was surprised when she told me recently that she does not self-identify as a Muslim unless it comes up. She doesn't wear hijab, so there's no obvious reason. And I said, why? And she said, well, it just complicates things. It just complicates things. That seems like a difficult way to live.
It is a difficult way to live. I mean, one survey found that 50% of Muslims say that they don't share their religious identity for fear of discrimination, or there are some occasions where they will not share it. And I think that we all as Americans actually lose something when we have people in our country that are afraid to self-identify as who they are. That means that we are living in a toxic political climate when we can't all bring our whole selves into our country and we can't be who we are and state our identity openly, there's something wrong, and everyone suffers.
3.3 million estimated Muslims in America now, about 1% of the population. And Dalia is saying estimated to be the second largest religious group in the country by the middle of this century. Muslims, the youngest, the most racially diverse major religious community in the country, sort of equal parts white, black, Asian, Arab, and very young. Half the population of Muslims in the U.S., younger than 35, compared to about a quarter of Protestants, just for one example. Dawood Waleed, you're in Detroit. Michigan has a very strong Muslim population. You're African-American and Muslim. Do you feel the kind of problems that that Dean says he feels more now than any time since 9/11 or any time in his life? Or are you just part of the community fabric and you don't feel that?
Well, what concerns me more is the institutionalization of Islamophobia, not necessarily some of the political rhetoric that's coming from people like Trump and from the right, although that rhetoric is very disconcerting, to say the least.
What do you mean by institutionalization, Dawood?
Well, what I mean by the institutionalization is that, yeah, there is anti-Muslim rhetoric going on, but we've really seen, especially in the Obama era and with the rising of the Tea Party, organized efforts to discriminate against Muslims as part of public policy. So, for instance, here in the state of Michigan, there have been a number of very well-organized campaigns in which zoning boards and planning commissions have blocked the zoning or expansions of mosques as well as Islamic schools all throughout the United States of America, including the state of Michigan. Though it didn't get passed here, there are so-called anti-Sharia or anti-Islam laws. And then we have the expansion of the surveillance state, of mass surveillance, and particularly during the Obama administration, where there's been an increase of surveillance in our community. Some of that, in which the Edward Snowden leaks revealed, in which the executive director of my national organization based in D.C., that the NSA was tracking his lawful activities for a number of years. So this is what I mean by the institutionalization of Islamophobia. Similarly to there's a type of institutionalized anti-black racism in America that leads to things such as racial profiling and mass incarceration.
Dean, if that's going on, why do you think it's going on? Is there some nativism brewing in the U.S. On its own accord? Or what about the external factors and some internal too? But you people sure. Watch ISIS and they think, oh my, what is going on here? You know, they look at attacks like we saw in Paris, San Bernardino, and get pretty freaked out by that. And how do you see those things weighing in to the difficult climate that you described, Dean?
They definitely play a role. There's no doubt it's sort of a stew of elements that is resulting in the complex world we live in today, the challenging world we live in today. I think, and I talk to Muslim groups and I tell them, if you don't know, just say you didn't know a Muslim and all you saw on TV was ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and then amped up by the rhetoric of people on the right, you're going to be afraid of Muslims. Doesn't mean you have any right to be a bigot, but you're going to feel less than warm about us. That's why polls show only about 27-28% of Americans have a positive view of Muslims, the last poll I saw. Partly, also you mentioned, we're 1% of the country. Overwhelmingly, Americans don't know a Muslim. I mean, I start my radio show every week saying, I'm Dean Obidala and I want to be your Muslim friend. And while it's light on some level, the reality is polls have shown that people who know a Muslim have a more positive view of Muslim and Islam overall. So the challenge that we're a small community, we're easy to bully, we're easy to demonize, we're red meat to people on the right. And it's not just Donald Trump. As Dahlia's covered, as many of us talked about, there's people like John Bennett in Oklahoma, state representative a couple of years ago, saying Islam, Muslims are a cancer in this country that should be cut out. Republican got a standing ovation. You had Bobby Jindal during the campaign saying Muslims won't impose no-go zones. We hear this rhetoric, this drumbeat of negative rhetoric, and few Democrats stand up to counter. There are more now, thankfully. And there are two members of Congress who are Democrats, Andre Carson, Keith Ellison, both Muslim Americans. They push back, but we're really outside of the media generally narrative, and we're being defined by others. That's the struggle. We're not in politics enough. We're not in the media enough. At least that's my view, and those are the ways that change our perception in this country.
Let me go to Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Famous address in this, precisely in this front here. Lexi, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was calling because I had a question specifically for Dahlia. Obviously, in case you don't know the Murfreesboro history, there was a lot of controversy here concerning the Islamic Center of Murfreesboro.
A very big mosque put up there. Yeah.
Yes, yes. The story was basically they had outgrown the place that they had been for decades in our city. They needed a new place, and they got it all approved through the city council the way they should have. But there was some backlash from the community because they didn't feel like they had been informed. And then there were terrible rumors of terrorists in our backyard, and it was just really ugly. My question for Dahlia is, how am I, as a young person in my community, supposed to help engage people and foster understanding between Muslim and non-Muslim communities?
Dahlia?
Well, it's a wonderful question. Thank you so much for asking. First, I think that, you know, at these town hall meetings, at these city council meetings, when it comes to mosques expanding or being built, what often happens is the loudest voices, who are usually the most hateful, are the only ones we hear. And all of the other people, which I know are the majority, who disagree with this kind of bigotry, either don't show up to those meetings or aren't vocal. I think just something so simple is to show up. Come, go to those meetings and make your voice heard and speak for American values. Be just as loud as the hate, but overwhelm it with your numbers. I think that's the first step. The second one is to cooperate, to build coalitions against hate and against injustice in general. You know, one interesting study that my institute came out with actually showed that anti-Muslim legislation, anti-Sharia legislation that we've been discussing, corresponds or overlaps with other legislation that hurts other minority groups. So this is not an isolated problem. Islamophobia is a threat to everyone.
Is anti-Sharia legislation necessarily anti-Muslim, Dahlia?
Here's why it becomes anti-Muslim. Anti-Sharia legislation, I thought, was just sort of something ridiculous. It's a law against something that's never going to happen. But it actually does impact real people, because what it ends up doing is outlawing the use of, you know, even anything that's inspired by religious law in even personal matters of law. So if I have a divorce decree that has some language in there that is inspired by my faith, it is suddenly now not admissible in court. If I have a will that is based on my belief system, I can't use it in an American court. But a Christian and a Jew or anyone else can bring their legal document inspired by their faith with that language in there, and it's perfectly admissible. So it is clear religious discrimination against Muslims. And so we pass it just to make a statement. I mean, the man who authored the template for the anti-Sharia legislation openly states that he did so that people would start to question what Sharia is, and basically heightens fear of Muslims and Islam in America. So these anti-Sharia legislation, they're for the purpose of just fear-mongering, but they actually end up really hurting real people in real ways. And there's an 80% overlap between anti-Sharia legislation and legislation that curtails the rights of African Americans and minorities, labor unions, women, the gay community, and immigrants.
Dawood in Detroit, do you want or need Sharia law observed in your community in any way? Or is that even important to you?
Well, I think firstly, there's a clarification of what Sharia is, which means a path towards faithfulness. Sharia is what guides us praying five times a day, fasting the month of Ramadan, looking
but
after
do you need
the
it
property
in law?
Of our neighbors. Mm-hmm. No, I have to give a clarification of what mm-hmm. Sharia is, because mm-hmm. sometimes Sharia and actual law is conflated, when really Sharia is just like halakha or Jewish law. But as Dahlia stated, if it comes to these issues of divorce or wills, then our religious practices should be respected in that process, just like Jews, Christians, or any other religious group. And there is no such thing everything is separate but equal, where there are certain First Amendment rights that are bestowed upon Jewish Americans or Christians.
Ruth, stand by. We're up against a break. This is On Point. We'll be right back with our panel. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We are talking before Sunday evening, start of Ramadan, with American Muslims about being Muslim in America now. The sound behind us here of the iftar meal. Last year, President Obama invited members of the Muslim community to an iftar, the evening meal where Muslims break their fast during Ramadan. There was a call to prayer at the White House. You can hear right there. We've got a panel from across the country. Dino Medalla with us from New York City. Hosai Mojedidi from Cupertino, California. Dawood Walid, Imam, with us from Detroit, Michigan. And Dalia Mogahed with us from Washington, D.C. and the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. You can join us this hour. Muslims, what are you thinking as we go into Ramadan this year? Are you thinking religious politics? Are you thinking the American dream? When there's a report of violence out there, do you pray, please don't let it be a Muslim? What will you be praying for this Ramadan? Dino Medalla says it's tougher now than it's ever been for American Muslims sometimes. Tougher than right after 9/11. Here's the sound of high school sophomores in Vermont using slam poetry to create change, they say, and challenge stereotypes about Muslims. They call themselves Muslim Girls Making Change. In April, they performed their poem, Wake Up America, on Vermont Public Radio.
Wake up, America. The enemy is here.
The terrorists.
Jihadists. Arabs.
The womanizers.
Monsters.
Bin Ladens.
The ones to watch out for.
Surveil.
To remove.
To attack.
But actually, we're the advocates.
The award winners.
The bilinguals.
Hello.
Hola.
Bonjour.
Guten Tag.
Assalamu alaikum.
We're the 4.0 students.
Honor roll students.
The star athletes.
But we're also the misunderstood.
Muslim Girls Against Change right there from Vermont Public Radio. And here, we had this trial of Somali-American men charged with attempting to join ISIS in Minnesota, drawing interest from around the country. And one observer who calls himself Average Muhammad, active on social media, lectures to Muslims about the faith and defeating extremist ideology. Here he is talking last week with Minnesota Public Radio.
What is it that makes a young kid give up the privileges and rights of being an American, with all the good things that come along with it, to want to leave our country, go join others who want to kill us? That always shocks me.
Dino Medalla in New York, what about it? I mean, from a non-Muslim, and maybe even to you, but from the media, it can look like Islam is wracked by extremism in many parts of the world. Do you see that as a true impression of what's going on in Islam today? And if it is, why? I mean, you look at ISIS, and then there's Al-Qaeda, and then there's just unrest and what appears like unhappiness and just very unsettled politics in many parts of the world right now around Islam. Is that an accurate impression? And if it is, why?
I think it's certainly an impression that certain of our fellow Americans hold when they talk about Islam.
But is it accurate? That's my, we know we hold it, but is it accurate?
Right. So, is it accurate?
ISIS looks like a big deal.
I think it all depends on your understanding of the issues that are around the world. Why do people commit certain acts of violence? For someone who believes ISIS is acting in the name of Islam, it's a very hard conversation for me to convince them that they have a political agenda. If there was such a thing as radical Islam, a made-up word, then why does ISIS and al-Qaeda literally kill each other on the killing fields of Syria? If there was a radical Islam that they both adhered to, they would be united. You know, the struggle is with the media often in America, and it's putting to our fellow Americans the risks in having a hierarchy where people understand what's really risking, what could really kill you and what might not. And I wrote an article for the Daily Beast just last week about Donald Trump touting guns, the greatest thing in the world, guns, the same week demonizing Muslims. Yet since 9/11 on U.S. soil, there's been less than 50 Americans killed by Muslims who are committing acts of terror. It's horrible there's been 50 people killed, but there's been 50. There's been 165,000 plus Americans killed in that same time by gun violence. Since January, 5,000 Americans killed by gun violence. Today, 30 Americans will die by gun violence, but we will not have that challenging, uncomfortable conversation about gun violence in this country. Instead, it's much easier to point your finger at the other.
Dean, I hear that. And forgive me, but with respect, I mean, I get it. Those are important numbers, and it's important to put things in. I totally get it. But I mean, but you're a radio guy, so I feel like you're ducking, or maybe I'm not putting my question to you in the right way. I feel like you're ducking it, though. Even for you, when you look out at the Islamic world,
right.
Don't you see a lot of distress? I do.
Well, there is distress, but each country, the Muslim world is not monolithic.
Well, the heart of it is in the Middle East. And
right, some of the Middle East, some South Asia.
Isn't there something more than just politics? Is there some – help us understand why we see so much there right now. Do you see it as strictly political and economic, just with a gloss or a mask of religion put over it? Or is there something in the Muslim community itself or the way it's interacting with the rest of the world that's leading to high stress, high tension, high conflict?
I absolutely don't see it as a clash of civilization type of scenario.
Within
the Muslim world. Every conflict we can talk about, we can talk about for hours what's causing them. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict is different motivating factors for the people there who are fighting than those, let's say, in Syria who are fighting a civil war or in Yemen or perhaps in South Asia. Each one is different. The idea that they happen to all be Muslim in name, does that for some people, that's the easy connecting tissue. In reality, it's not. They're isolated incidents. There's a reason for each of them, what's going on. Are they united by Islam? Is that a great recruiting tool? Sure, it is. Are they opening up the Quran, go to page 13, let's go kill someone? No. It's a political agenda which they use the faith to justify and recruit. It's a very powerful religion.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen all different religions use the power of their faith to recruit, inspire people to do good and bad things. So unfortunately, what we see are some bad things going on. There are definitely Islamic terrorists. We can't deny that. But ISIS is maybe, what, 60, 80,000 people?
Mm-hmm.
0.001% mm-hmm. of the entire faith. But how much media coverage does that 0.001% of our faith get? That defines us. That's my point about mm-hmm. the facts. It's not to deflect. There are some bad Muslims. Don't get me wrong. They would kill everyone on the show in a second because to us, we're not good Muslims. We're not like them.
To them.
But mm-hmm. it's a small, teeny, less than 1%.
Yep. I want to again, identify that group we heard just there, Muslim Girls Making Change. Let me be very clear about the name of that group. Peter in Boston. Thanks for calling, Peter. You're on the air.
Yeah, Tom. Interesting topic. And first, let me preface my remarks. I clearly believe in the rule of law as a veteran attorney that any type of, Muslims and Americans that are violated by any, people doing wrongful criminal activities, I absolutely should be prosecuted to the fullest extent. Same thing with the Jewish people and the anti-Semitic things. That being said, I'm kind of an independent, and again, I have major problems with Trump, but I think he hits an issue with a lot of people like me who react with, listen, I do have a problem. I'm not a fearful of Muslims. I'm apprehensive of Islamic terrorists. You've got, like somebody commented, you've got 88,000 that were fighting in Syria, and now you have about 2 million in Europe. A good percentage are unvetted and have no documentation. I understand we're taking 170,000 people in. And I think Trump, again, his rhetoric is overblown, and I think obviously that he constitutionally there's problems with it.
Well, what's your question, Peter? Where are you going here?
Is this? I think there's a legitimate concern with a lot of people, like with now, mm-hmm. Muslims coming in, Islamic, with the potential of being terrorists. How can they be vetted if they have no documents?
Let us pick it up. Dahlia, you're in Washington, where policy gets made around this. This is not an uncommon concern. How do you respond?
I think there's actually a lot easier ways to get into our country if you want to do us harm than being a refugee.
Yeah.
They are the most carefully vetted people that enter this country. And the facts just don't bear out this perception that they are a risk. We've had countries already take in literally hundreds of thousands, if not in some cases millions, of Syrian refugees, and they have not had this problem. The countries in the Middle East, countries like Turkey, that their problems are not coming from their refugees. That is just not where the source is. These people are running for their lives, and they are escaping the same violence that we are fearful of. So it's just not a rational fear to point to these desperate people as a source of a security threat. They are literally the most carefully vetted people that enter this country.
I mean, and not that many. The president set a goal of, I think, 10,000, but the latest I saw just a couple of days ago, it's only admitted about 2,500. Hosai and Cupertino, your family came as refugees from Afghanistan. Now, a long time ago now, 30, 40 years ago, when you look at the Syrian refugees and what this country is and is not doing for them, what are your thoughts?
I mean, it's heart-wrenching. I'm sure, like everybody on the panel, we've all seen the images. And of course, I, even though I was very young to remember those things, I've heard the stories my whole life about how difficult it was for my parents with five young ones under eight, I believe, to leave under very difficult and dangerous conditions to get to safe passage. And their lives were threatened. They were bribed. They were, just abused in many different ways in order to get to where we are, thankfully, today. So of course, when I see those images, it's horrible. And to see the most vulnerable people being, questioned. I mean, like Delia said, they're escaping, and it's, horrible conditions that none of us can even, I think, fathom. I mean, to have bombs dropping over your head, to have lost family members, to not feel safe to walk outside and have your kids play in the front yard. This is not a way that human beings should live anywhere in the world. And these people are leaving those circumstances. I mean, we just had 800 people drowning just this past weekend, and there was nothing in the media about that. Very little. The lives are being
lost. Not nothing.
Lost.
We've talked about it right here, I must say, and I've heard it elsewhere. So not nothing.
Okay, sorry. I didn't hear your program. I should go back and listen to it. But unfortunately, I think it wasn't. I didn't see as much about it coverage as I did the unfortunate incident with the zoo. That just took over the media.
Yeah,
it seemed
true.
It's definitely difficult to see that, and I think like I said, we're demonizing people who are really they have nothing. They have nothing, and we need to touch base, get back into our humanity and see that they need our help. They need to know that the values that we espouse as Americans are true, and that we do love to help people. That's what we pride ourselves on. That we have we're a people of giving and loving. And yep. So these are the things that I think we need to extend to them.
Dawood, in Detroit, I mean, people do look at ISIS. That Europe looked at the number of young men who went from Europe. The U.S. has been much, much smaller. The FBI director Comey said recently maybe 6 or 8 or 10 a month. That was back in 2014, 2015. And these days he said maybe one a month out of a country the size of ours. That's very small. And yet there is that little trickle there. How do you think about radicalization? And when it happens, why it happens, Dawood?
Well, I believe that the very minuscule amount of young Muslims that decided they want to go abroad, I think that is it's more based upon sociological reasons and maybe not so much so on theology, where people, for whatever reason, feel like they don't feel like they're a part of the society. I would say that a much higher percentage of young Muslims end up getting involved in drugs or actually drug gang activity. But, there are people who are at home on keyboard, on their computers and their smartphones. They feel lonely, and the people that reach out to them or may feel appealing may be people online. It's definitely not an issue of people getting radicalized in mosque, and federal officials have said that. It's more someone halfway across the world appealing to lonely and confused young men and women.
Anne in Concord, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my... I want to thank your panel and direct my question to Dahlia. I'm a feminist, married to a feminist, hopefully raising feminist offspring who are sensitive to all people. And I have Muslim friends, and I haven't quite been able to really ask them this the way I'd like to ask you, but how can I explain a full burqa to my child who saw a woman in that on a hot day? And at the same time, I've had Muslim cab drivers who told me that women must wear this because we need to protect men from their horniness, for lack of a better term. And this whole piece, I'm confused, and I really, really want to understand, be able to support and give a good answer to kids.
Dahlia?
Well, thank you so much for asking me, and I'm glad that I can be the safe space for you to ask these questions. Let me take a step back and just explain that as a Muslim, now I'm speaking as a Muslim, I believe in gender equality, and this is what I teach my kids. And I also believe that God commanded both men and women to behave in a modest and respectful way to one another. The dress code for women and men is actually not very different. They're both asked to cover and privatize their sexuality. And that's done for the purpose of really desexualizing the public space. It's not to protect men from their horniness. That's a very strange way to explain it. It's really done as an act of devotion, and both men and women are asked to do this. It's about choice. It's about being able to choose who we share our sexuality and our intimacy with.
Full burqa, and we've seen the pictures in Saudi Arabia of women, you know, having the switches at their ankles. If they just showed their ankles, is it really willing and voluntary? It can look to American feminists like a big imposition.
No, you're right. I think, you know, there are exceptions to the idea of being willing and voluntary, but I think we have to talk about the rule before the exception. Mm-hmm. And the rule, and I'm basing this on surveys, is that women who cover are doing so willingly. This is their interpretation of their faith, and they find a certain empowerment in it. I certainly do. Now, in the case where it's forced, where it's politicized, where it's even politicized in a violent way, that is completely unacceptable. But it is very important that we not conflate those exceptions with the rule, and that we allow women their agency. It may not be your choice. Just as it's not my choice, and I marvel at women in mini skirts when it's 30 below. I'm from Wisconsin, and yeah. You know, college students would walk around that way, and I'm you know, in awe of that. I can't even understand it. But we have to allow people their agency and not project our own framework onto them.
I think on this Friday, before the Sunday that will mark the start of Ramadan, that's about as far as we're going to get today. It's a big, big continent of interest, and we barely begin to scratch it. But I'm so grateful to all three of you for helping us do just that. Dalia Mahagad in Washington, thank you very much for being with us today, Dalia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Imam Dawood Waleed in Detroit, thank you, Dawood Waleed.
Thank you very much.
In Cupertino, California, Hosseini Mojedidi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And in New York, Dean Obidala. Thank you, Dean, for being
perfect.
With us. Thank you
very
much.
Thank you, Tom. And thanks for doing this panel again.
You are very welcome. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.